equal time. Another viewpoint, other considerations. Equal time.
And I'm Carl Etten, I are today's host for Equal Time Radio. And as usual on Mondays, my theme is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. If you're interested in reading more about it, I've got a blog at Relocalizing Vermont. It's at vermontcommons.org/blog. Let me rephrase that. The blog is called Relocalizing Vermont, and it's found at the Vermont Commons website, vtcommons.org/blog. Also, the audio of the Equal Time Radio broadcast that I do and that Travin does on Tuesdays, you can find after the show. I try to put it up within 24 hours or so at equaltimeradio.com, www.equaltimeradio.com. Got a great show coming up for you today. Two guests. Robin McDermott is a host of the weekly radio show The Dinner Hour. It's on a low-power FM station in the Mad River Valley, and she's going to talk about her show and how to save money by eating locally and other food issues. This is part of a continuing series that I've been doing with radio hosts who have shows kind of similar to my theme. And then in the second part of the show, we'll be talking with Jericho Farmer and former president of Ben & Jerry's, Chuck Lacey, about the barriers to small-scale agriculture in Vermont. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the sun. Enjoying these sunny days? I've got to tell you about the way cool playing in the sun I've been doing. It started out with a solar version of the slow cooker, and it's moved on to a solar-powered ray gun. I've been making sun tea for years. It's a type of solar cooking, I guess, but my real start with solar cooking came last year when I made a solar oven out of some cardboard boxes, some plastic peanuts, a little aluminized Mylar, and a piece of translucent polycarbonate held together with Elmer's glue and packing tape. I think it probably cost about $5 to build. The thing worked pretty well as a slow cooker on sunny, still days. But up where I live, it's pretty windy, so the reflector would catch the wind, and it'd either come down and close off the sun, or it'd move the whole kit and caboodle around in the wind. So I went and got myself a low-slung, aerodynamic, reflectorless solar cooker from the Solar Oven Society. Started using that last fall. The wind doesn't seem to bother it much. And with the sun out a lot now and growing stronger, I've started using it again. Friday, I cooked up a pot of potatoes. Saturday, it was a black bean stew. It wasn't quite enough heat from the sun to cook the beans completely, even leaving it out there all day, but half an hour on very low heat on the range finished their cooking. Yesterday, I cooked a pot of beets in the sun. Today, the oven's taking the day off, but I've got chicken thawing for a dish of arroz con pollo, rice with chicken, for tomorrow if it's sunny again, although listening to Roger Hill, it sounds like it won't be quite as sunny tomorrow as it is today. Anyway, got a new toy on Saturday, the beginnings of a parabolic cooker. Someone wanted to get rid of a satellite dish she wasn't using anymore. So this former wild blue satellite dish is about 27 inches in diameter, and some friends and I covered it with self-adhesive aluminized Mylar I bought at the ReStore. The idea is that a parabolic dish reflects and focuses the incoming light from the direction it's aimed. So you aim this 27-inch diameter dish at the sun, you get a very hot circle of light about an inch wide at the focal point. And this baby can cook. Even at 5:45 in the evening with the sun sinking, I put a sheet of newspaper in the focal point and got it to start on fire within about 5 seconds. The pictures of it are pretty good. I put some photos up at my blog, vtcommons.org. I think it's pretty impressive to see the initial puff of smoke lit up by the intense white glow of the focused solar rays. So guys like playing with fire, especially unusual forms of fire. Remember that team of male engineers in Indiana who competed to see how fast they could light a pile of charcoal in a barbecue grill? The winning technique used about 3 gallons of liquid oxygen poured onto a lit cigarette using a 10-foot pole. Dave Barry, he wrote a column about it 10 years ago or so, and he helpfully explained, in terms of releasing energy, pouring liquid oxygen on charcoal is the equivalent of throwing a live squirrel into a room containing 50 million Labrador retrievers. I'll let that image sink in for a minute. So guys like playing with fire, and I'm a guy, and I like sources of energy that will be around when the oil stops flowing, so you gotta believe I like this solar ray gun. I haven't tried boiling water with it yet, which is a whole point of making it into a solar cooker. I need to mount the dish on a pole and build a way to hold a kettle or a pot or something at the focal point first. I am looking forward to cooking with this thing. It's a good excuse to keep playing with the new solar ray gun. If you want to know more about solar cooking, learn how to make your own slow cooker or a ray gun, there are lots of websites out there. A good one to start with is simply called www.solarcooking.org. Bon appétit. And with that, it's a good time to transition into our interview with the Dinner Hour woman, Robin McDermott, who for 4 years now has been hosting a radio show by that very name at WMRW LP in the Mad River Valley. Robin, welcome to the show.
Hi, Carl. How you doing?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Beautiful day out today, isn't it?
You betcha. You doing any solar cooking up there?
You need these sunny days to be able to cook your dinner.
That's right. You've been doing any solar cooking up there?
No, I haven't. Uh-huh. I do sun tea and maybe sun-dried tomatoes.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, tell us about this Dinner Hour show that you've been doing for 4 years now.
Yeah, well, I have been, as you said, doing the Dinner Hour for 4 years. WMRW LP is a community radio station in Warren, Vermont, and it serves the Mad River Valley. And the station started up about 4.5 years ago. So I think it was 2004, October of 2004. And I had recently, at that point, moved here from Connecticut. And there was a really great food talk radio show that was on. And I was hoping somebody would kind of step up to the plate at WMRW and have some type of food talk radio show. And no one did. So I finally, like 6 months after the station started, I thought, well, you know, if no one else is going to do it, then mine, something is better than nothing. So I'm going to be the one who does it. So that's how it got started.
Yeah, they say if you want something done right, do it yourself. And sometimes if you want something done, do it yourself.
Yeah, well, I think that that's kind of what happened. And it's funny because when I first started, I could never imagine filling an hour every week with food talk. So it actually started out being called Dinner and a Show, and my idea was that I was going to combine food tips along with Broadway tunes, which I also love. And my first show, I chose the Sound of Music, which is not a real good idea living in the Mad River Valley with Von Trapp all over the place.
Yeah, they've heard a lot about the Sound of Music in the Mad River Valley.
George Thomas, who many people know, was my mentor. George does jazz with George on VPR. And so he kind of was like staring at me. He was like, drop the whole show thing, you know, let's just do dinner talk.
So, mm-hmm. So how many shows did you go through before you decided to drop the show bit?
One.
Okay. A short experiment.
Well, it's funny, and I'm sure you've experienced this too. I mean, you're sure that you're not going to have enough material for a show, and so you gather all this information, and you go and you do the show, and you realize that you got through a tenth of it.
Right. Well, on WMRW, there's another show. I haven't had the host of that show on yet, but it's scheduled for a half hour. It goes over regularly, and it's just about bees and honey.
Oh, yeah, that's fabulous, the bee line. And that was originally, it was Bob Tracy's bee line, and it still is. Bob was kind of the elder beekeeper in town, and he passed away, I think it was a little over a year ago. And Gib Geiger, who's now kind of filled his shoes as our new beekeeper, has taken on that show. And so, yeah, it's a great show.
So if he can talk about honey and bees for half an hour, then that's one very small specialized part of food. So you should be able
You're
to
right.
talk about the rest of the food in the rest of the half hour.
Absolutely.
In an hour. And your show is broadcast at the Dinner Hour in its original live performance.
It is, and I'm very proud to say my website is up to date. And I do, from this point forward, will be trying to get my shows up there within 24 hours of broadcast.
All right, but so. It's 5 p.m. on Tuesday, and that's the Dinner Hour in my
that's
house,
correct.
At least.
Yep. Yep. And the website is www.dinnerhour.org, and I've got all of my shows up there. I put them up there not because I want people to listen to me, but I've had some fabulous guests on. And so I want people to be able to hear those guests, and it's very difficult in our mountainous valley here to access the radio station. So it's another way for people to listen to the Dinner Hour.
Mm. And if listeners are wondering what the heck I'm doing on WDEV interviewing somebody about a show on a different station, this is part of an ongoing series of interviews that I've been doing to find people with shows out there that are somewhat similar to my theme, which is energy, food, and the local economy at the end of the age of oil. So we talked with the host of Deconstructing Dinner, John Steinman, a Canadian show. We talked with the host, Michael Olson, of the Food Chain Radio. There's a big food component in these shows. And then one that's not so food-focused is a reality report, Jason Bradford, out from Willits, California. We've been doing that over the past couple months, and we'll continue doing that. And the reason I do that is because it's not so common when you are flipping through the radio dial to find a show about a theme related to this. And I just want listeners to know that there are people all over this continent who are thinking along these lines.
Absolutely. You know, my hero is John Steinman, so...
Deconstructing Dinner host.
Yep, absolutely.
And I just love his Canadian accent.
It sounds kind of like yours, Carl.
People sometimes say that. I came from Wisconsin originally.
Yeah, huh. Very interesting.
But I don't say a boot.
No, you don't.
I say about. So what have you been talking about lately on the Dinner Hour, Robin?
Well, it's kind of interesting because I think what I've been talking about lately is what... kind of how my thinking about food has evolved over the past 4 years. I mean, I started out, the Dinner Hour has always been about fresh, local, and healthy food, but I think that initially it was more on food, and now it's much more emphasis on the local aspects of food, and that just really reflects kind of my morphing and my thinking. How my thinking has changed over the past 4 years. So
I'm going to stop you for a minute there, Robin, because I just remember that I completely forgot to give people a telephone number. And, of course, people are welcome to call in to talk to you about local food or whatever at 244-1777. Or the toll-free number, if you're outside the Waterbury area, is 877-291-8255. I'm sorry, so go ahead.
So anyway, recently I've been thinking, I'm very active with the Mad River Valley Local Voar Project. So I've been a committed local voar for almost 3 years now. And one of the challenges about eating local that I'm constantly hearing is the cost of, you know, eating local is too expensive. And my husband and I, who have been doing it for 3 years now, and anyone else who eats local on a regular basis, not just for the challenge, you know, week or month, but eats local on a regular basis, will tell you that it's much less expensive to eat on an all-local diet. And so what I've been trying to do on my radio show recently, with some features I've done, is really help people start to see how it is possible to eat local and have it be less expensive.
Mm-hmm. And how is it possible?
Well, you know, one of the things that I've been thinking about is the way that peasants eat. Peasants, you know, there are people who are farmers, or, you know, basically they're subsistence types of farmers. They may be fishermen, fisher people. They may be ranchers. They may be farmers. But they're growing their primary job in life is growing their own food and sustaining themselves. And so if you look at how peasants eat versus how the royalty eat, I think therein lies some of the tips for how a local voar can eat.
For example, what kind of meat you eat?
Absolutely. I mean, we're used to, in the United States, we're used to sitting down with a huge slab of steak in front of us. We don't really give any thought to what happened to the rest of the animal. We want something that we can easily throw on the grill. And that really is kind of a royalty mindset about eating. Whereas the peasants, you know, the royalty got those finer cuts and the things that you could cook quickly. And the peasants had to cook with the lesser cuts of meat. And make the most of absolutely everything that they had because that was all that they had. So I think that if we start thinking in terms of eating like peasants, that we'll find that eating local is a lot less expensive. Now, so, people go, but I don't want to eat like a peasant. You know, I want to eat like a king. But when you look at the cuisines, you know, the great cuisines in the world, French, they have their beef bourguignon. That's a peasant dish. You know, Italian dishes, many of the famous Italian dishes are peasant dishes. I mean, the things that we really like about cuisines from around the world very often boil down to their peasant dishes.
Don't you think people will miss their caviar and hummingbird tongues?
Hummingbird tongues? you know, I think that there is a place for having some really delicious wild card ingredients. But I don't think it has to be on our plate every single day. And I think that type of thinking has gotten us to where we are, whether we're talking about food or energy or anything else. It's the whole attitude of, I want what I want when I want it, and I deserve it. And unfortunately, that way of thinking has made us voracious consumers and not really contributors to the health of the planet.
We're talking with Robin McDermott. She's a local vore extraordinaire in the Mad River Valley, and on WMRW Low Power, she is a host of The Dinner Hour every week. The number here, if you'd like to talk to her, is 244-1777 or 877 toll-free, 877-291-8255. We're going to go to the phones to Montpelier. Hello, Bob.
Hi, this is Bob from Montpelier. It all sounds good that we can shop local at the co-op and all, but I find the prices to be quite exorbitant, and even though it's local, I don't understand why something coming from Calais costs $5 a pound, and something coming from California costs $2 a pound.
What are you thinking about in particular, Bob?
Almost everything. If you go to the local co-op and you go to purchase something, the prices are just much, much higher for the same product. I know it's being mass-produced in California, but it's being shipped across the country. It's being handled by thousands of people. When you have one local farmer grow something and then you have to pay $4 or $5 a pound for something that you can go to Shaw's or Price Chopper and pay $1.89 a pound for, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And it all sounds good, what Robin's saying, but realistically, I find it hard to believe.
Robin, your response.
Well, you know, I absolutely understand what you're saying. What I've learned about the difference between industrial food and local food is that much of industrial food is subsidized. And the cost of that industrial food, we don't necessarily see. For example, all the pollution that's being created out in California because of these huge factory farms that they have out there. So we're not incurring those same costs with local Vermont farms that we do with those farms out in California. But I was 4 years ago, I was the one when we lived in Connecticut, we had a grocery store there called Big Y, and they would have buy one, get two free pork chops or buy one, get two free chickens. And I was the one who was always buying those because they were a fabulous deal. And what I found is only way that I can get over that hurdle of the difference in price is I simply don't look at the prices in the grocery store because I don't think they're a fair representation of the total price of that industrial commodity type of food.
Bob, what do you think of Robin's suggestion of changing the diet so that you're eating lower on the hog in a pretty literal way, eating different cuts of meat?
I'm not necessarily talking about meats. I'm mostly talking about fresh produce grown here in Vermont. Uh-huh. Like I said, you know, she says she doesn't look at the price, and that's a great thing if you can get away with it. But most people have to look at the price of what they're purchasing. And even though it is part of the big industrial operation, when it comes down to you have $50 to go shopping with and you go to the co-op and your bill for two or three meals is $50, at the end of the week when you're out of food, what do you do then?
Do you grow your own food at all, Bob?
Quite a bit of it.
How do you figure that comes out cost-wise?
Time-wise, time is nothing sometimes to me, money-wise, but it's better in the long run and everything's good, but I still don't understand when something's coming from Calais and it's, you know, $4 or $5 a pound and something grown in California. I know it's being subsidized and all, but it's just, you know, people like Robin saying this, it all sounds good, but when you're there checking out at the co-op and the prices are exorbitant, it's hard to go along with her program. You know, somehow the farmers around here could really produce the product at a realistic price, maybe not as low as the subsidized farms in California, but just a little less than what they're asking for now. Maybe more people would get involved in shopping locally. But at this point in time, it's very difficult for your average Vermonter to even consider it.
Well, thanks for your call, Bob.
Oh, thank you very much for my time.
Appreciate it. So,
yeah.
Bye. Robin, where do you think the least expensive place to get local food is, other than your own backyard raising it yourself?
Well, you know, I think a CSA is a good approach because I think that you're probably getting fairly good money value for your money there.
CSA is community supported agriculture, where you pay a certain amount up front to a farmer and then get shares every week of the harvest.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, the farmers market is, or farm stands are another approach. I mean, as much as I love the co-op, you have to keep in mind that when you're giving the co-op your dollar, a portion of that money is going to the co-op and a portion of it's going to the farmer. Whereas if you're paying the farmer directly through a CSA or through a farm stand or through the farmer's market, they're getting much more of that money, and I think they can offer the food to you for a lower cost.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bob, you know, is, I think his effort of growing some of his own food is also a part of the solution. I don't believe that if we in Vermont depended on Vermont farmers to feed us, I do not believe that Vermont could feed itself. But I believe that if everyone in Vermont, or the majority of people in Vermont, are willing to take on growing or raising some of their own food, I think that we would be in a much better position to be able to be self-sustaining in terms of food in the state.
Mm-hmm. Well, the people I talk to in the Montpelier area say that the demand for local food at this point is greater than what the local farmers are able to supply.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
So the other thing that I... you know, that I like to throw out there is, I mean, right now, I never buy produce in the grocery store. Right now, what I'm doing as far as vegetables is I put up a lot of vegetables last year from things that I grew or from things that I purchased from farmers. I don't buy lettuce at the grocery store. My rule is I never buy any greens unless they're grown in Vermont. So basically, I don't eat salads in winter.
Mm-hmm.
I have started growing some of my own soil sprouts, so that's, in fact, I'm going to have one for lunch, a soil sprout salad for lunch when I get off the phone with you. But, you know, it's much less expensive for me to do that. So I'm not going into the grocery store and buying produce. So when I say I don't look at those prices, I mean, I just literally don't even go into the grocery store to see them. I consider myself the poster child for local forest because I was about, you know, people say, well, did you start, like, by kind of buying organic and at the co-op? And I said, no, I went right from, you know, the buy one, get two free meats to, you know, being a true local forest to the point where about 80% of what we eat is local.
Hmm. We're going to go to the phones again to Hyde Park. We've got Mark on the phone.
How you doing?
Hey, Mark.
I think a previous caller makes a good point that, you know, a lot of us just can't be militant about this type of thing. You know, you divide your passions, and often your passions dip into your pocketbook. And, you know, this particular, your guest's passion is local for. I'm all for it, but I'm also a capitalist. I also believe that the free market works, that, you know, a good idea gets latched onto by people. I think people would really like to buy more local. And so my question is, what's the local war movement doing to get local products into grocery stores where people go? I mean, often, you know, if I'm standing at a meat counter and I've got a choice between local beef and Western beef, and it's $2 a pound more for the local, I'm going to buy the local if it's there, if it's available to me. And that's my point. What are you doing to work with the folks that are good old-fashioned capitalists who, you know, to show them what the market is and get them moving on selling this stuff to people?
Good question. So more than the food co-op, the grocery stores. Robin?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a capitalist too. Hold
on a minute. Mark, we're having a hard time hearing because of background noise. Could you cover up your handset there?
Sure.
Thank you. Go ahead, Robin.
First of all, the local workers are really a grassroots organization. So, we have very limited ability to influence grocery stores. I know that independent grocery stores are going to be much more willing to stock local ingredients than the larger grocery stores. So that's who I work with. I'm part of the Mad River Valley Local Board Project, and we're very localized in terms of our efforts. So I've got a great relationship with our local grocery store, Mahuron, and I can go in there and I can ask Tom Mahuron to get some type of local food in, and as much as he'll say, oh my God, Robin, where am I going to put it? I'll go in there a week later and it'll be in there. So I don't know what the answer is as far as those big chains and getting local food in there.
A lot of it is just that, as you were saying, we're not producing enough food to feed from all of Vermont right now.
Right.
So there's plenty of distribution mechanisms for what is being produced and brought to market. I think we'll be addressing this question more in the second half of the show when we talk with Chuck Lacey about some of the barriers to small-scale farmers bringing their food to market here in Vermont.
Mark, I
want to thank you for your call. We did cut you off there because there was so much noise coming from the background. I could hardly hear Robin over that background noise. So sorry to cut you off, but thanks for the call.
I wanted to point out also that at the Mad River Valley Local Board Project's website, it's www.vermontlocalboard.org. Right on that home page, if you scroll down, there's a copy of my presentation that I gave at the NOFA, Northeast Organic Farming Association Winter Conference. And I did quite a few comparisons of things like your own home canned tomatoes versus, you know, spaghetti sauce that you would buy in the grocery store. And there are a lot of those types of price comparisons. And it's really amazing how the local food can be less expensive.
So that's at www.vermontlocalvore.org.
That's correct.
To find your presentation, Robin McDermott's presentation at the NOFA Winter Conference last month on price with some good comparisons. Do you have that at your fingertips, Robin? Can you just give us some comparisons?
I can get it at my fingertips
okay.
at the moment. Let me see if I can find it here.
And while you're doing that, I'll let people know that after the break, we'll be talking with Chuck Lacey. He is a farmer in Jericho, involved in a lot of agriculture business enterprises, and former president of Ben & Jerry's. And while you're further looking, I'll say that our current guest is Robin McDermott. She is a host of The Dinner Hour on WMRW Low Power 95.1 FM in the Mad River Valley. And that's broadcast Tuesdays at 5 o'clock and rebroadcast on Friday mornings at 9, I believe. And
great. So, okay, one example is yogurt.
Yogurt.
I make mayo and yogurt. Very easy to make. Takes very little time. I make it for 28 cents a serving.
Where do you get your milk?
I get my milk from a dairy farm down the road, an organic dairy farm.
Okay.
But the 28 cents was based on grocery store prices for organic milk.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 28 cents a serving. If you want to add a tablespoon of maple syrup, it's an additional 12 cents. But compare that to $1 a serving for Stonyfield organic, you know, the little cup containers that they have.
Mm-hmm.
Or even 67 cents a serving for Butterworks that comes in the large quart container.
Okay.
So it's something that's very quick and easy to do.
Mm-hmm. One more comparison, and we're about out of time.
Another great comparison are beans. There are some great black beans and different kinds of beans that are grown locally. 80 cents a cup for cooked beans versus a can of Bush's baked beans is a dollar, and a Bush's black beans is $1.11 for one cup.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I have several comparisons like that. They're not all great. There's one that I have in there.
I think we're going to end right there because we've got another guest coming on. But you can see the whole thing at www.vermontlocalvore.org. And you'll be back with, what's your show next week?
My show tomorrow is going to be with the publishers of Vermont's Local Banquet.
Okay. Very good. Well, Robin McDermott, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great. Okay. Thanks a lot, Carl.
Okay. Bye. We'll be back right after this.